We attended a larger party the next night, with a group of wealthy merchants from both the kingdom of Arankosho and the Yadosha city-states. This time, Polaire was dressed like a princess, in silver and gold, and it brought out the gray in her eyes. The style of her hua was bolder, more brazen. Her hair was skillfully piled up on top of her head and kept in place by half a dozen hairpins, where bright diamonds dangled, and long ringlets of brown hair framed her face. I had done my research and had once again donned my maroon hua, but had not made myself up to the extent that she did. The group of men greeted our arrival with cheers and guffaws, the noise loud in the usually quiet tea room of the Golden Bough. It was early in the evening, and most were already drunk, or at least well on their way to being drunk.
Ah, Polaire! We were wondering where you were. And who is this pretty little thing?
One of the men bounded over. The tallest I've ever met. His hair and beard were golden, his face a healthy pink and white. But the hand that enveloped both of mine in a hearty handshake was brown and weather-beaten, and twice my size.
Don't be so free with my little sister, Aiden!
Polaire scolded, slapping his hand away.
Didn't I tell you to behave this time around? Or will I have to stick your head into the pond outside again?
Rather than be outraged, the men laughed harder.
She got you there, Aiden!
One called out, shorter and wirier than the bearded merchant, with a thicker accent.
The last time you shook a flannen with Lady Polaire, she sent you headfirst into the fountain. I remember her chasing Balfour around with that pole they clean the garden's fish ponds with. Mad as hops she was.
I was tipsy,
the red-haired man with darker skin protested.
You were tipsy, all right. Tipped right into the stream.
The group roared again. A tea-room attendant hurried in briefly, setting large tankards of a foamy golden drink on the table, and hurried out. I was ushered into a place among the cushions, between Polaire and a dark-skinned man who was younger than his silver hair suggested.
Your younger sister, you say?
Aiden continued.
What's your name?
It's Tia, my lord.
My lord?
Another one of the men guffawed.
No need for formalities. We're all friends here. Tia! What an odd name.
It's spelled like the drink, Isamu, Polaire explained.
How strange to name someone after a drink. Where are you from? Tia. Kion.
Her skin's too dark for Kion, Isamu, someone said. She looks Odalian, if anything. Or perhaps even Drichta.
I'm Odalian, sir.
I'm Jaloyan.
The man bowed. Unlike Aiden, his beard was black, carefully trimmed and shaped so they were thin lines that crisscrossed his face.
It's hard to tell who the locals are in Ankyo,
Isamu protested.
Look at Nox here. He's as black as night. But he comes from Yadosha like the rest of you.
Yadosha is also a melting pot, Jaloyan observed. Not like you people in Arankosho. You all look the same.
That is not true.
One of Isamu's countrymen extended his arm out, palms facing upward.
See? My skin is darker than Isamu's.
I can't tell the difference.
Aiden complained.
Isamu, hold out your arm alongside Aitos.
Fairly soon, all the men in the room, all respected merchants, all rough-and-tumble men of influential standing, had their arms out, comparing skin tones. I had no idea what was going on.
Aiden's arm is much darker than his face, see? He doesn't even have the same color on himself. I work outside. My face isn't covered the way my arms are.
Polaire, what about you?
I think I will go and dunk myself in the spring outside if Lady Asha is darker than mine.
Maybe only in the places that count,
Aito said slyly. That was enough to set the men off again,
We apologize,
Nock said to me.
We have known each other for years. I remember now,
Aiden said.
Isn't Tia the dark Asha who nearly obliterated the Falling Leaf tea room?
I winced. I'm sorry.
No, no, Deloyan said. That wasn't her fault. And no one blames you, little miss. In fact, people have been asking for you, wanting to know if Asha novices can be invited to the Chahana regularly. I'd say you'll have mistresses of the other tea rooms knocking at your door, demanding that you wreck theirs, too.
He laughed when I turned red.
Ah, don't mind me. I say these things just to make the pretty girls blush. Here, have some alut.
I'm afraid Tia is still too young for your horrible drinks, gentlemen,
Polaire said primly. To my horror, she went and smacked the man lightly on the nose when he tried to hand me a glass anyway.
You Yedoshans! Always looking for any excuse to get drunk!
But that's why you like us, Polaire,
Aiden said childishly.
Deloyan is offering to pay for all our meals, so let's grub up some cants that the ladies might like. Would that be apology enough, Lady Polaire?
Polaire's response was to tap him playfully on the cheek, and the men laughed again.
Yedoshans like to fight and argue,
she explained to me after the party ended and we were walking back home.
Aran Kosho tend to be more reserved as a people, until they get drunk. You cannot treat everyone in the same way when you entertain them, Tia. Yedoshans sulk and get bored easily when you do not share in their revelry. Trisayans are superstitious and like to get straight to the point in discussions, but drink even harder than the Yedoshans. Drichta are... Well, I'm sure you can already imagine what the Drichta are. There will be a few exceptions, but this is the general rule. What can you say about your own fellow Odalians?
I thought. Hard-working for the most part, but very concerned with money. They're suspicious of outsiders and of magic. No, they're only suspicious of magic that other people use, but not when they do.
Exactly. Would you say that your family, too, or your friends in Knight's Cross can be described in this manner?
But my family are nothing like that at all. The people in Knight's Cross aren't...
And then I paused. I thought about their distrust of bone witches, their hostility toward me. Were they any different, after all, than the cold treatment Lady Michaela and I received from strangers in Neve? She nodded at my growing understanding.
That's right. Over the course of your life, you will meet many, many people. The trick an Asha must learn is to read people accurately. So if a Trisayan comes in and consumes a stupid amount of Kulshea and grunts at everyone in the room, then he is a typical Trisayan to whom small talk will have no effect. And if you understand Trisayans, you will wait patiently until he finally chooses to speak. But if he is a Trisayan who is fond of chatter and has an eye for fashion, then you must ask Rahim what he is doing at such a party.
I giggled. Polaire flicked her dark hair over one shoulder, the diamonds in it twinkling in the twilight.
Everyone is a puzzle, Tia. Made of interlocking tiles you must piece together to form a picture of their souls. But to successfully build them, you must have an idea of their strengths as well as their weaknesses.
We all have them, she said, adding almost as an afterthought. Even me.
She carried another vial in her hands. Black liquid sloshed inside from one of the many cauldrons that had gutted the landscape with its smoke and odors the last couple of days. We stood before the hulking carcass of a mastodon-like beast. Only its rib cage remained intact, wide enough for us to pass through. Two brown tusks lay nearby. The ends of one lay broken, the other buried so deep underneath the sand that only its tip gleamed out at us through the muddied churning of seawater. The girl lifted the bottle to her lips and drank until there was nothing left. When she was done, she let it fall from her grasp, and before it hit the ground, she was already moving, performing the same ritual as she had with the Tarvi. Something that resembled lightning lanced through the bones, circled the massive ribs, and struck at the barely visible tusk. And then the skeleton moved. It struggled to stand, and the tusks rose, attracted to the rest of its body like a magnet. It settled atop the bony jaws. One by one, like a life-sized puzzle, it built and took form. Femurs attached themselves to pelvic bones and tibia, vertebrae lining up to collarbone and neck spurs. What it could not find, it created out of thin air. And throughout it all, the girl never stopped. Her fingers danced and her feet moved, and she circled her creation like a parent awaiting the birth of her child, until the massive being rose before her, whole and complete. Magic spun into flesh. Imagine if you had the power to control Deva like these. Imagine the kingdoms that would quake and tremble before you. With such a threat at their borders, how quickly do you think they would mend their ways? Would more people fall under King Adil of Drich's iron grip? Would he look out from the windows of his castle and see us at his gates and still send innocents to the headsman's block? Would he still exile those like you who strive for a truth he does not wish to see? Would murderers in his kingdom still go unpunished for killing their daughters? And if I turned my Tarvi and my Akvan southward to cross the rolling plains of Odalia to enter the kingdom of Kion, would the Asha of Ankhyo regret what they did to the man I loved? The Akvan shook the sand and water from its hide and bayed at the rising moon. Its black heart shone, suspended in the breeze, until the girl reached out and plucked it from the air. "Do they not understand?" the girl asked, her voice so very soft. "That they are nothing more than playthings in the eyes of Deva?"
22. Lady Michaela was finally allowed out of bed a month after my Kahar day, though restricted to the immediate vicinity of the willows. Mistress Parmina had banned her from taking up any new requests outside of Ankhyo, and dismissed all her protests to the contrary.
"You are more important than anything they might ask of you,"
she informed her firmly.
"The next Deva to require raising will not be for another year. You will stay here and attend to your younger sister until I have deemed you fit enough to work. And that is all there is to say about the matter."
My sister still tired easily, and always excused herself early in the evening, much to my worry. "She will get better," Polaire told me often, though occasionally I would detect minute changes in her heart's glass as she spoke. A brief spatter of blue, too quick for anyone else to notice. Lady Michaela asked me one day to accompany her out into the fields outside of Ankhyo, the same ones Asha used for training practice. She had also asked Fox to join us. My brother still limped, and his face looked more drawn than I was accustomed to, but he was otherwise unchanged. I felt guilty. My free time had been gradually taken up by the lessons my new sisters had begun to teach me, and I had been seeing less and less of him. Taken for granted the bond we shared as an excuse that he was doing well, that the army took his time from me as much as my lessons took me from him. "I told you once that death would make the better of us. And that holds true for your brother, at least." Michaela looked especially lovely today. Some of the color returned to her cheeks. Instead of her hua, she wore a flowing dress that was pleated at the knees and tightened around the waist by a long belt made of shiny blue silk. Her hair was unadorned. "Hold out your finger. This may sting a little." I had barely held it out when Lady Michaela moved, and a sliver of a blade sliced through my skin. Small drops of blood trickled down the wound, but I stood stock still, not moving despite that tiny blush of pain.
I had seen the Asha do this when she had raised that Tower V nearly 2 years ago. How long ago that was to me. Now, draw the heart's rune for me again. I stared at her, finger dripping red. Confusion unmistakable. To draw the heart's rune was the last thing I expected her to make me do. She laughed and laid a hand on Fox's shoulder. Only then did I see the new heart's glass case that hung around his neck. It was simpler than Lady Michaela's and mine, bound by a small white chain instead of gold embellishments. I would have thought it obvious. But he can't! He can. Not for the usual things we use them for, no. Not to exchange wedding vows with or to delve for illnesses. His heart will be silver-marked and identical in every way to yours. No one who knows the magic will mistake him for anything but what he is, a bone which is familiar. But even the dead have uses for a heart. Even one they're given instead of the one they were born with. Go ahead. Fox said nothing, only waited. With shaking fingers, I drew the heart's rune in the space between us. The red flowed from my finger and followed the path my hand took, staining the breeze with every movement, so that when I was done, the symbol stood before me, written in my own blood. I felt that welcome rush of relief and elation as the magic filled me up, infused itself into the rune. The heart's glass rippled once, twice, took hold. Mist filled the tiny case, swirling into every nook and corner. At the same time, Fox opened his mouth, took a breath, and exhaled noisily. His first since his death. His face no longer looked wan and sallow. Color leached back into his face, a healthy pink from neck and chin to cheeks and forehead, and it warmed every feature it touched. He will be stronger, Lady Michaela said. Faster than when he was living. Tougher. Unkillable by normal means. He will need blooding for every half and full moon, and only your blood will take. He will never be fully alive, but this is the closest to living that the dead can know. It is, naturally, your brother's choice. Fox examined his hand, flexed his fingers. They no longer creaked like old bones.
I would like to stay for as long as Tia wants me to, he said.
His eyes were brighter, smiling at the corners, like he had found more reasons to laugh at the world. Then stay, I said, and my hands shook. If I can make you stronger, and if I can help you live the life you ought to have had, then stay. For as long as you want and for as long as I can. Fox watched me fidget and shiver, and when I felt the tears welling up in my eyes, he opened his arms. I ran into them without another word. For the first time since his death, Fox was warm and smelled of home. The graveyard lay on the outskirts of the city, a sensible distance for citizens to pay their respects to the dead without intruding on their territory. I looked around, wondering what traces remained of the damage I had caused. But the masons and bricklayers of Unkyo were efficient workers, and the only things out of place were the few new headstones whose polished brightness stood out among the weather-beaten graves like bad notes. But I was uneasy. The cemetery was divided into two fields, one allotted for more recent burials, the other for graves dating back centuries. We stood in the latter. Heart's glass were not originally created for courtship, nor were they crafted for business, Michaela said as we stood among the rows of dead. In the olden days, Asha were employed in battlefields, and so noblemen and others of royal blood took to wearing heart's glass in battle, because even there, they were granted special privileges. If they fared badly in their wars,
Bone witches from the opposing side could take their heart's glass instead of their lives. Better a prisoner than dead, apparently. Over time, other soldiers protested this treatment and began wearing heart's glass of their own, until the Asha could no longer distinguish between commoner and royal.
As things should be,
Fox noted.
Lady Michaela drew another symbol in the air.
This is the Rune of Raising. I'm sure you recognize this.
I nodded. It was the rune I had raised Fox with, a feat I could not recreate no matter how many times I tried on my own. Once, without anyone's knowledge save Fox's, in the quiet stillness of the night, I crept out of the Valerian and tried to recreate the summon Lady Michaela had performed on the Tauri, on the carcass of a rotting beetle. You knew I'd fail, I accused my brother when nothing happened. Even with only him to see, I could not hide my embarrassment. He had thought it a terrible idea, but had done little to dissuade me.
And so did you, he returned.
I couldn't find a wittier response. Had slunk back inside.
And this is why you were given slices of runeberries for the better part of your training, my sister explained. The dark takes more from you than you might think, and every casting can make you weaker, more vulnerable. The berries make up the difference, and will keep your strength up. Follow exactly as I do, and direct it toward this grave.
Lady Michaela drew the rune again, and I copied her movements, the blood from my cut hand floating around me, settling into its shape. This time, I felt the tingling along the length of my arm when my fingers drew at the air, sparking at the tips. As she instructed, I guided the thriving energy down to one of the stones, at the bones I could feel lying underneath. There was a shifting in the soil, and the ground before us caved in. Something clawed its way out of the small hole that appeared. It had lain dormant for so long that any remaining bits of skin hung like rags around its bones, its skull shorn of all hair. I could see a string of pure energy that wound along my raised finger, attached to what was left of its waist. The corpse fixed an eyeless gaze on us and rattled. Its form was almost skeletal, but its voice was as clear as spring in my mind.
I will never tell you!
The words snapped at us, shrill and angry.
He's my child, and nothing else matters!
Ask for her consent, Lady Michaela said. I gritted my teeth. The corpse's stench turned my stomach, but I persevered. Do you accept me? I directed that thought toward the rotting apparition.
I will never tell you his father's name!
The corpse rattled.
I'll carry his secret to my grave!
It's not working! A peculiar buzzing began in my head, and it began hurting. Whether it was because of the dead woman's ferocity or the strength it was taking to maintain contact with her, I wasn't sure. She's not listening!
Try to command her.
Never! You will never taint my family name with your vile lies!
I can't! The noise grew worse. I clutched at my head.
Let her go! Michaela ordered. Cut through the string that binds you both.
I forced my will through the rope of energy between us, severing our connection. Immediately the corpse sagged, bereft of life once more, and toppled back into the open grave.
That was Lady Lisette, Lady Michaela said, a former Odalian duchess. King Telamane's many times great aunt, and King Randall's wife. Buried here instead of at the royal tombs because of her fall from grace. For reasons we now know since you raised the old king. The dead cannot lie, but they can withhold the truth. That is the first rule of the dark. You cannot compel the dead if they are not willing. The Duchess is a benign corpse and harmless enough for our purpose. Other dead will not be as gentle. If they do not consent, deprive them of their movements quickly. They will use your strength to attack you for as long as your bond remains.
She had me practice this rune for a month. On graves Lady Michaela herself had raised in her youth, taught to her by other dark Asha that came before her, or on the bones of small animals. Unlike their human counterparts, the animals did not need consent. And I soon learned to distinguish between the corpses who were willing and those who were not almost as soon as they rose from their mounds. But Michaela had me return the dead, human or animal, compliant or not, to their rest every time. Because to maintain Fox, she said, was difficult enough for a young Asha in training. Besides, she added, I have something else in mind for you. The stallion was of a sturdy breed, born and raised in the Gorvacan steppes of Isterra. The short, bandy-legged tribes that called that barren veldt their home bred this steed for war and territory, but were ill at ease in Ankyo. They were an unusual sight to see, and people turned to stare at the two men, tall and covered in fur save for their bare legs sticking out underneath, armed with crude swords and pushing a makeshift wheelbarrow that contained two lifeless stallions through the streets of the Willows. The Gorvacai were an unsmiling tribe, whose men and women shaved their heads and wore fur that draped loosely about their persons, yet also muffled the contours of their bodies at the same time. At least 300 leagues lay between Isterra and Kion, and I could not imagine how they had accomplished the journey the way they had, and with two dead beasts in tow. Lady Michaela awaited them at the entrance to the Valerian. As the crowd watched, the two men lifted the corpses with unusual care, with a gentleness that belied their fierce, bearded faces. Once the horses were laid on the ground, they took a step back. One of them addressed the Asha in a harsh, nearly guttural language, and I was shocked to hear her respond in kind. She approached the dead animals, cutting her hand as she did. Several drops of blood spilled onto one of the horses, and in no time at all, it stirred and stood up on all fours, whinnying and stamping its feet. A few people gasped, and most of our audience retreated when it turned and regarded them with bright eyes, like it meant to attack. Lady Michaela extended a hand out. "Come here," she said. It tossed its head at the watchers one last time and approached her. It nuzzled at her fingers like a puppy might. "There are two horses," Lady Michaela called out to me. "Would you care for the other?" I very much did. I walked forward eagerly, saw Fox keeping in step beside me. More blood, and soon the second horse was up, trotting across the street with its head proudly raised. The Gorvacai made no sound, only bowed to Michaela 3 times, and left without another word, their empty wagon creaking behind them. "A favor for a favor," Michaela explained, but said nothing more. The horses themselves were magnificent, and their love of duty and honor showed in their bones. They held their heads high, were docile in their rest, and did not require feeding. Michaela was delighted and named her mount Kismet. Mine was half a tail smaller in size, but I called him Chief. They took to us, and they also took to Fox, who found a nearby stable, paid its owner twice as much to keep them away from the curious public, and cared for them whenever we were busy. "Dark called to Dark," he said, and the horses called to him as strongly as he called to them. "How do you feel?" Lady Michaela asked me a day later. I was riding astride Chief, exploring the streets of Ankyo for the first time on horseback, and she was on Kismet. "Stronger." I'd thought an additional familiar would make things more exhausting for me, but the opposite was true. "The Gorvacai have a special connection with their horses. The bond draws and provides strength for both. It is not magic. Nothing that even Asha understand.
Only bone witches can do the same as them with Gorvakan's steeds, and only in death. She watched me for a long moment, then sighed and nudged Kismet forward. And I followed. What was it like to be dead? I asked one early summer evening while I watched my brother at practice. They had given him leave to stay at the Valerian if he wanted to. Or, rather, Fox, taking Lady Hami's suggestion, began to visit more regularly and for longer periods, and Mistress Parmina gave no protest. But Fox rarely entered the Ashaka, preferring instead to remain outside. It was a rare outing for us. Althea was at the Ankyo Palace, still serving as Princess Inessa's bodyguard, and Poler was at the Flowing Waters Chahana, entertaining at an important function that frowned on mere novices. Lady Michaela and Mistress Parmina napped inside the Ashaka. I was astride chief again. My mouth was occupied with smoked ham. I ate in small bites and constant meals nowadays, because blood and runes took strength and gave back appetite.
Nothing and everything at once,
Fox replied and swiped with his blade at a falling leaf. It folded itself into two halves at his feet. The leaves cast a shadow on the ground, and I cast a shadow too. But though he looked more alive than he had before, Fox and Chief had none.
Colder, without feeling. Grayer, without seeing. Alive but without aim. Hunger without flavor.
I watched him batter at a bare trunk with a plain sword, glinting steel against dead bark. The pallor had long since left his face, and his legs no longer creaked and spasmed. Some days it was easier to believe that I was not a bone witch watching my creation, but just a sister watching a sibling at swordplay. I closed my eyes. The bond between us was stronger than ever, and I could pinpoint with near accuracy just how far away he was from me without seeing him. I also sensed Chief below me, impatient at remaining still.
As it should be with your familiars,
Lady Michaela had told me.
It is the same on their end, and their instinct will always be to seek you out to protect you at the first signs of danger. That he is your brother makes the chains between you even harder to break.
Canter, I told Chief. The horse whinnied and began. He pranced across the street, encircling the large oak tree that stood across from the Ashaka and then returning. I had brushed his white coat beforehand until it gleamed. Chief knew he was the best-looking horse in Ankyo and was not afraid to let everyone else know it. Did it hurt? I had never asked Fox this before. Heartless Fox had been quiet and distant, always watchful and concerned. He could sound angry and sad and worried and happy, but never would his expression change to suit the emotion. Heartful Fox was different, more prone to show with his face and his eyes what his words meant. More of the brother I remembered and less of the shade that had remained. Fox paused to think about it.
It did at first. We were patrolling the swamps that separated Odalia from Kion. News reached the king of some strange creature lurking there, feasting on nearby villages. There were bodies, half-eaten and ruined beyond recognition. Another regiment brought one to the camp the day before, and I threw up the small army rations I had for breakfast all over my new boots.
He made a face at the memory, then flicked at the small half-leaf, turned it over.
I was the first one to die, I think. I was scouting ahead of my group, because I was quiet on my feet and never one to talk much, and I counted on that to see things before they see me. It didn't matter, though, because the creature was like a shadow and made no sound at all. I managed to shout out a warning before it jumped me. One swipe of the claw. Shock and pain. And then nothing.
He paused and lifted up his shirt, and I saw the claw marks knifed across his body in 3 red streaks. Half-healed, and no longer the gaping wound it had been that night at the snow pyre.
That's horrible. I shuddered and turned my head away, not wanting to look at the fatal injury that had claimed his life. Fox only looked thoughtful.
I would like to face it again. For my pride, if nothing else. There are days now when I can make no sound either.
He held out his arm and made a quick, shallow cut at the back of his hand with the sword. A small wound gaped back. But for all his pink-faced, alive-seeming countenance, Fox did not bleed. I slid off Chief's back and moved toward him.
It's only a small cut, Tia. You don't need to.
But I need the practice, too. There's a reason I've been eating those rune berries, as terrible as they taste.
I cut my finger with my knife, a new gift from Lady Michaela for this purpose. I allowed the blood to drip onto his palms. The brown of my skin was paler now due to my frequent bloodletting, because after that first lesson, there had been many more for Lady Michaela to teach. Many more still to learn. The blood spread across my brother's skin, seeped into the flesh. He turned his hand over, and the wound was gone. The marks he wore on his chest retreated but did not diminish completely, and remained red-stained and angry.
One day, Fox said,
and Chief neighed in agreement.
The Tauravi was suspicious at first. The other Deva was larger and more ungainly on its feet, and it tottered as it walked, until time smoothed out its stride. They moved in a circle, sniffing each other warily. The girl said nothing, and watched them with an old smile on her young face. Finally, the Tauravi raised its head and let out a bellow. The Akvan did the same, its tusks twitching. With a growl, the Tauravi sprang onto the Akvan. They grappled for several seconds, rolling in the sand. Finally, the Akvan let out a gleeful cry, and I realized they were playing. The Tauravi disengaged, shook itself free. It returned to smelling the other creature's hide. The Akvan butted it affectionately on the stomach, and the monster flopped onto its side, purring again. If the rest of us could only get along so well, the girl mused.
23. The Darashi Oyun took place one cool evening just 3 months after my Kahar Day. The intricacy of the scenery, from the gold leaves scattered about to mimic a forest clearing, to the sparks of silver diamonds hanging above us to resemble stars, took my breath away. I plumbed the air for traces of the spells made to enhance our surroundings, to instill a sense of awe and wonder in those less attuned to the magic, but found none. Asha take the Darashi Oyun seriously, and to resort to such tricks cheapens the performances. But many of those who attended did not hold themselves to such standards, and the magic they wore on their clothes and hair was nauseating to my senses. The crescent amethyst hairpin in my hair was sufficient enough to ward off the worst of those spells, but I could feel them all the same. The first of the Hiwa Rahim made for me had arrived the previous day, and I was dumbstruck by his skill. It was of a beautiful emerald green, with silver leaves and fan-shaped patterns around my waist and down one side. It complemented my dark gray underrobe and my white waist wrap, which had embossed outlines of doves at play. Lady Michaela told me it was a typical Hua that apprentices wore. I would have more control of the designs I preferred after my debut. Besides the crescent pin, I wore a dark green tortoiseshell comb in my hair, and one of the silver hairpins Lick had first picked out for me. A jade design with a tail of tiny white streamers that brushed against the side of my cheek. Seeing royalty in the audience was a common sight at the Darashi Oyun. Nobles have been honored guests at these dances for hundreds of years, since the time Vernasha of the Roses performed for Mushan, the then emperor of Qian. Being subordinate Asha apprentices, we occupied seats in the middle row. The nobles occupied the front, while Asha, not participating in the dances, took the seats behind them. The rest of the populace, those who could afford to splurge on money to attend, took up the rear. I spotted my sisters Michaela and Polaire on my left, with Lady Shadi a seat behind them, and saw Zoya's friends on the far right. Alfie sat with Empress Alex farther up front. Some of the older Asha were seated together with the nobles, conversing with them like old friends. My history lesson served me well here. I recognized Tsar Camulus of Trisea and his queen. I saw the regal King Rendorvik of Estera and his three sons, five representatives of the Yadosha city-states, led by First Minister Stefan, and the Queen of Arankosho and her daughter, the Princess Maeve, who had talked cruelly about Lady Michaela at the Falling Leaf. Mistress Parmina was seated next to one of the Yadosha representatives, and something he said made her chuckle out loud. I was nervous. As was tradition, the stage was open to all who might wish to dance before the program commenced. Already several children had taken command of the stage, pirouetting and giggling in their best gowns. Few people in the audience paid them much attention. My heart beat faster when I caught sight of a familiar dark head as he sat two seats away from Empress Alex and the unmistakable figure of his father, King Telamene, a row before him, whose loud voice could be heard wherever you sat. Beside the king was his nephew, Kaelin, still dressed in black as before.
"What's wrong?"
Fox asked when I gripped his arm. An exception had been given for my brother, and he was allowed to sit beside me at the very end of the row. "Prince Kuntz is here," I said happily.
"Of course he is. Even the Tsar of Trisea has come to watch, if that really is the Tsar. I can't tell underneath all that fur."
I opened my mouth, but my witty rejoinder died at the sight of Prince Kuntz engaged in deep conversation with Princess Maeve, whose laughter was unmistakable despite the noisy chatter around us. She placed a hand on his arm and drew closer so that her head hovered over his shoulder. I forced myself to look away and stared hard at the stage, where an old woman was performing The Rise of the Sea Foam in jerky, half-remembered steps.
"I met a girl once when I was in the army,"
Fox said.
"Her name was Jezebel, and she was from Trisea. She was the prettiest girl I've ever seen, with the lightest yellow hair and the most fetching blue eyes. Her brother was a fellow soldier in the same regiment I was in. And because we were stationed for 3 months in Batlovo, their hometown, she visited us often. It took me 2 weeks to work up the nerve to ask her out. I finally made up my mind one day and bought flowers from the local florist, only to come across her kissing Maharvin, another fellow soldier but someone I had disliked long before. I was depressed for weeks."
"Fox, your romances with Trisean girls are the last thing I want to think about."
"But you should. It was difficult to see them together, especially when Jezebel had no idea how I felt. Especially because Maharvin was a rot, you see. Drank too much and could be nasty to the locals if he thought they were beneath him. He had some royal Denorian blood on his mother's side, or so he claimed. But I couldn't. I had a motive for seeing them apart, and she would know it if I broke them up, however good my reason would be."
I watched Fox out of the corner of my eye. He too stared straight ahead, at the now empty stage.
"It got better when we had to leave, and I didn't see her as much. But from time to time, Maharvin would get a letter from her, and I would feel jealous all the same. Just because I didn't see her as often didn't mean I didn't forget."
"But it's difficult all the same."
"It wouldn't be natural if it wasn't difficult."
He reached over and tapped at my heart's glass.
"Just remember what Lilac had always told us. What Lady Michaela always tells you.
and then his eyes widened, and he bit back a curse. I turned to follow his gaze, and spotted a familiar-looking girl now seated between Prince Kuntz and Empress Alex. Prince Kuntz immediately turned to her, and it was obvious that Princess Maeve was not pleased. It took me a moment to remember where I first saw her. Another second more to realize who she was. While I was taught to recognize the semi-reclusive Empress Alex by face, my lessons did not provide as much emphasis on her children. "The girl you were arguing with at the castle," I gasped. "You've been fighting with Princess Inessa?" Fox blushed for the first time since we entered Keon.
"It's complicated. I didn't realize who she was. I thought she was just another..."
"Didn't realize? Fox, are you hearing yourself?"
"It was a misunderstanding. I was hoping she wouldn't be here."
"Of course she is," I said, echoing his previous words. "Even the Tsar of Tresea has come to watch, if that really is the Tsar. I can't tell underneath all that fur."
Fox glared at me. But the drumming began. The rhythm was not a part of the main Asha performance. People craned their heads to look. Puzzled. And it was then that Lick danced into view. Rahim and Chesh had outdone themselves. The young boy wore a black hua with white roses that had gold-rimmed petals, and a modest copper-colored wrap. A crown of white roses circled his head, weaving into his long tresses. Lick was dancing the fox spirit song, where a beautiful fox demon was caught by hunters and forced to dance in order to gain her release. It was a second-tier piece I had watched other Asha rehearse several times before, but was not yet cleared to do myself. How had Lick learned this? The boy pirouetted and extended out a hand. Fire sprung to life, settled against his palm. The audience gasped, and Lick withdrew, leaving it suspended on nothing, and drew another fire rune at the next corner, repeating the movements until he was surrounded by balls of steady flames, licking at the air like candlelight. "Lick didn't tell us he was going to do that," I muttered. It was one thing to dance like an Asha, but to show them you could draw runes too was inviting trouble. They were going to seek him out afterward, and the boy knew it.
"Now you know how we feel every time you do something you neglect to tell us."
Fox was amused, to my irritation. A hush fell over the audience as Lick completed the dance, balancing himself on one leg while the other remained poised in the air on his left. When he finally sank down to the ground, extinguishing the balls of fire as he did, the applause was deafening. Lick's solemn demeanor disappeared, and he turned red. Chesh was already hurrying forward, her face beaming, to help the boy off the stage. "I have a good feeling about this," I whispered gleefully to Fox.
"I hope you're right,"
my brother whispered back.
"They might like him now, but opinions may shift later."
"You're a spoilsport, you know that?" I would have added more, but the torches flickering around the stage dimmed. The play was about to begin. For the dance, the Asha wore floor-length sleeves and full-body overcoats that opened at the front to expose silky inner garments, accentuated by hints of bosom. Asha played both male and female roles. The former's clothes were not as ornate, with scarves around their necks as long as the women's sleeves, but with shorter coats and trousers. The magic emanating from them was overpowering. My hairpins, created to withstand the worst of what the city could offer, tingled from the surplus. And with every additional garment the Asha wore, the greater the potential for higher magic stitched into the cloth. The dance itself was as old as the lands, as ancient as people remembered time. The villagers of Knight's Cross knew the story, acted it out in simple plays during the winter solstice. But paper masks and sticks were nothing against art in its fullest flavor, under the watchful eyes of rich patrons.
The Asha chorus had soft voices, but their words carried effortlessly. In the beginning, blade that soars. In the beginning, dancing wind. Two people danced into the center of the room. Lady Shadi wore an eye mask of unparalleled beauty, with tiny diamonds that encircled her eyes and golden agates that rounded out the corners of the cloth, set in stone along a profusion of sapphires and rubies. But the greatest of her treasures was a brilliant diamond around her neck, set inside a heart's glass case. Black onyx lined the man's mask, deepening the hollows of his cheeks and smoothing out the sternness of his chin. The woman tilted her hand up, a coquettish movement, and the man accepted. They ruled the sky as far as the wind took breath, the lands as wide as the ground held sand and soil, the seas as fathomless as their darkest depths. The god cloaked his lover in moonlight and wove stars into her hair. He gave her the brightest and most beautiful of gemstones, worn on her graceful neck. Magic flourished in abundance, rune berries plump and primed. Two more dancers entered. The second man wore an eye mask of midnight black. Rubies and sunstones painted his brow. The second woman wore a strange combination of moonstones and black pearl. While Lady Shadi wore a magnificent array of colors, Zoya's was a muted enterprise of black and gray. But not all creatures were happy. The god's brother was Hollow Knife. The god's beloved, a sister named Little Tears. Hollow Knife resented his brother, for the people loved Blade That Soars, and the younger sibling desired his influence. Little Tears, too, loved Blade That Soars, and hated her sister. The newcomers began their own dance, fierce, angry gestures. Hollow Knife came to Blade That Soars and said, "Brother, keeper of the winds and crown of the world, we are of one blood and of one purpose, with no secrets between us. I ask, where does your heart keep?" The Asha in the rubies and sunstone mask minced around the onyx-gilded dancer, a crafty satyr encircling his unwitting prey. And Blade That Soars told him, "Inside the egg of a nest in the highest tree, in the peak of the highest mountain, guarded by 12 rocks and 12 eagles as large as the sun and as swift as the fastest rivers. It is there, and only there, I keep my heart." And so Hollow Knife traveled to the mountain. He slew a dozen rocks and a dozen eagles, but when he reached into the nest to claim its prize, he saw it was only a normal egg, round and black speckled. And Blade That Soars berated him, saying, "Why do you seek to unman me, brother? My fields I have given freely, and my waters you can drink your fill. Do not seek what is not yours to take, for the world will suffer." "Forgive me, my brother," Hollow Knife groveled. And the dancer bent gracefully on one foot, her body straight as an arrow, muscles straining against her weight. "I only meant to see for myself that it was true, all the better to protect you from harm. But it is not right to lie to your own kin. I, who have only your best interests in mind." And so Blade That Soars relented and forgave him his treachery. After some time had passed, Hollow Knife came once more to Blade That Soars and said, "Brother, bearer of light and eye of the storm, we are of one blood and of one purpose, with no secrets between us. I ask, where does your heart keep?" And Blade That Soars told him, "Inside the belly of a fish, swimming in the lowest reaches of the deepest sea, guarded by 12 sharks and 12 kraken, as large as the moon and as fierce as the hottest fires. It is there,
And only there, I keep my heart. And so Hollow Knife traveled to the nethermost sea. He slew a dozen sharks and a dozen kraken, but when he took the fish to claim his prize, he saw that it was only a normal fish, small and white-tailed. And Blade That Soars berated him, saying, "Why do you seek to unman me, brother? My crops I have harvested for your care, and my animals I sacrifice for your meat. Do not seek what is not yours to take, for the world will suffer." "Forgive me, my brother," Hollow Knife groveled. "I only meant to seek for myself that it was true, all the better to protect you from harm. But it is not right to lie to your own kin. I, who have only your best interests in mind."
And again Blade That Soars relented and forgave him his treachery. More time passed, and Hollow Knife came to Blade That Soars one final time.
"Brother, guardian of man and soul of the heavens, we are of one blood and of one purpose, and with no secrets between us. I ask, where does your heart keep?"
And Blade That Soars told him,
"We are of one blood and of one purpose. There are no secrets between us. On the pendant that hangs around Dancing Wind's neck, from where shines the brightest light of the world, it is there, and only there, I keep my heart."
And so Hollow Knife sought out Little Tears and told her,
"If you wish to own my brother's heart, then you must do as I say. It lies within the heart's glass your sister wears. You must take it from her in the dead of night when she lies sleeping, when they are weak and unaware."
And so Little Tears, driven by jealousy, did as he ordered. In the thick of darkness, with only the light of the moon to guide her, she stole into the tent where her sister lay fast asleep. With deft fingers, she took the heart's glass and drew it over her head, and Dancing Wind, oblivious, slept soundly on. But Hollow Knife lay in wait, and when Little Tears emerged from the tent with the precious heart in her hand, he knocked her down and claimed the jewel for his own. With great and terrible force, he dashed the heart into the ground, and the beautiful gem shattered into countless pieces. A cry came from every creature in the land, for they felt their creator die, and their hearts along with him. Dancing Wind woke, but she was too late, for her lover lay dead beside her, and Hollow Knife's betrayal was complete. The dancer with the diamond-encrusted mask sank to her knees beside her partner's unmoving form, and the next dance she performed was slow and heavy with sorrow, but no less graceful for it. Hollow Knife wrested control. He gathered followers and infected them with his taint. He gave to himself instead of giving back to the sea and sky and lands, and the world suffered. He joined his heart's glass with the remains of Blade That Soars, and crafted a new, beautiful heart's glass that was as dark as shadows and ruin. With it, he created the Deva, worst of beasts, monsters whose grotesque forms mirrored his own heart. They blotted out the sun and turned the world into endless night, and the people wailed in terror and anguish. Among them, Hollow Knife ruled, laughing, as the false prince. But Dancing Wind was unbroken. "Help me, Little Tears," she implored her sister. "Help me gather Blade That Soars heart, so I can make him whole." "It is an impossible task," was her cruel reply. There are more pieces of his heart than there are stars in the sky, and grains of sand on the ground. That is one. To repair it, you must